This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We are on location with Anne Harding Woodworth, and we are so glad Anne is here with us, and she's going to start with a poem.
Thank you, Grace. What a delight to be here with you. This is called Looking Homeward. Bill Waldron spared my mother and father agony by teaching me how to drive a stick in a cornfield. Think of it as an H, he said, of the lever that came out of the steering shaft of his two-door Dodge, which my mother called a coupe. We were on the two-rut road around the field that the tractor took to get in and out at planting and harvest. The grassy hump sometimes hit the underside, and Bill would say, "Oh my God, downshift, girl, ease her up," which wasn't hard as long as I remembered to clutch, or the car would stutter over itself. And on the passenger side, Bill would get thrown around almost to bumping his nose on the dash. He had a big nose, talked as if he had a cold, and his eye was on my older sister who dreamed of boys and going to Africa. I felt pretty important as the vehicle to her heart, though I knew Bill didn't have a prayer. My sister married a Rhodes Scholar and went to Uganda for Uhuru. Bill married the daughter of the town monument maker and took over the business before he even had a chance to look away. He marked my father's, then my mother's grave, so they won't ever be forgotten in that town I drove out of.
Anne Harding Woodworth, I requested that poem because it was featured on Best American Poetry, which is Terrence Winch's posting, but it is really a national publication. I just loved that so much because I would teach that poem to show how you start with memory, but then it's not any good unless you insert it with a story within the story of your sister. And that is really the perfect poem. But I also want to talk to you about memory because you use that a lot. And, you know, it's common as dirt. What is memory worth?
Everything. I do use memory a lot. You're right. And I'm sometimes not even aware that I'm doing it. Even with imaginary characters that I make up, sometimes memory gets right into them.
It's a miracle because it is so common, one would not think it had any value. But what is the value in poetry?
One would think that it doesn't have any value.
Well, because it's so prolific. It's so prolific. Everyone has it. If everyone has it, does it have value?
Yeah, well.
Well, maybe it's like love. Well,
everyone has different memories, and I just love reading poems of memory. I love hearing other people's memories. Speaking of Terrence Winch, perhaps you saw his poem called Survivor, an absolutely beautiful and moving.
You're right. You hit it on the head when you say everyone has different memories. No one can have the others, and that is what makes a wonderful poem. So, Anne, do read us two poems together and set them up, and we'll know who Anne Harding Woodworth really is. I'm so glad to see you.
It's great to be here. The first one I'm going to read is about, this isn't quite a memory poem, but it is based on the fact that I have a collection of gloves that I have picked up off the street. They're all single gloves. I've got now I have 17 of them, but when I wrote this poem, I had 12, and 11 of them were for the left hand, and one was for the right. And sometimes I put these gloves on in the winter. You know, I find two that might match a little bit, one with the right and one with the left. This is called On the Other Hand. I pick up gloves lost in the street, put them in a pocket, take them home. I have a dozen. Two are brown, 10 black, 11 for the left hand. Four are made for men in overcoats, 8 for women going far too fast. The one right glove, fur-filled and exotic, pretends an elegance that doesn't match a single other. 5 are leather, 3 are yarn with cable stitches, all are piled parallel in dark in a drawer of pine. They look like hands, of course, some chubbier than others, but they despair, I think, and are deprived of loved, familiar flesh, solitary gloves unpaired, melancholy digits seeking touch. And so their vacancies I fill at times with part of me when I am cold, and winter's made my fingers stiff. Serenity, to enter into where another used to be, like fitting tight into a man who gently holds my naked hand.
Oh, Anne, thank you for that. Melancholy digits seeking touch. You really did find all those gloves?
I do. I have I can show you a picture. I've taken a picture.
Oh, Anne, what a wonderful poem.
You know, I read that poem once at a reading, and a few days later, a box came in the mail from a friend up in Massachusetts who had heard me read this poem. And he said he had been walking down the street of Amherst, and he saw a glove on the sidewalk. He walked right past it, but he thought of me. The next day, he went back, and it was still there, and he picked it up, and he sent it to me. So that's why.
I will never see a glove alone again without thinking of you.
Just pick it up.
To bring it home, I know I was going to ask you to read two poems, but I couldn't help but jump in. To bring it home that way with a rhyming couplet just makes a hand inside. It just makes the hand fit the glove. That is brilliant. You know, why did you use couplets? Because I always think couplets contain laws. Do you think that's implicit?
I've never thought of that. I use couplets a lot. Yeah. And I find that recently I have been rhyming the last couplet.
But because it worked.
I wrote one about Emily Dickinson the other day where I rhymed the last two lines.
I'm not going to interrupt you if you'll give two in a row.
Okay, well, these kind of go together. This is called Surgery on a Poem, and I would rather be in the state of revision than any other thing in writing my poetry. I love revising, and this is called Surgery on a Poem, and sometimes you can go too far with revision. In the OR, it's opened with a knife. Something yellow spurts over primroses and chipmunks that have sourced themselves along a cheerful artery. Cutting the cute out reveals deeper smells and swirls, crimson updrafts seeking air toward grit skies over cities of alleys and plywood windows. Grocery carts filled with unwashed blankets, paper bags, and cardboard under bridges. Dirt and sirens, coughed mucus spill out. Homeless, words are desperation now, strung formless in iambs that carom nervous off the green-tiled walls. Beauty's gone, bleeding goes unstanched, anapests anesthetized ooze onto the floor, unaware of what's happening. What is happening? Is there no meaning left? Emptiness, unconnectedness, the eye and ear sore of stain and void. Clichés, usually true, mark all effort to make things better, except that surgery can go so awry, hand so unsteady.
It's so interesting because everyone hates to revise.
Really?
That's where the work is.
I know it is.
People love that flash of inspiration, the high you get, but that's where you're in the trenches. But I want to let everyone know who you are and that your last book was Trouble. Is that right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that also had some drama in it. So you're a dramatist as well. And your new book, you were actually writing in verse. So there's going to be two novellas in verse in your new book?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. How do you do that? Do you get characters and situations and then literally just put it in stanzas?
Oh, well, I do. One of these novellas in verse is all rhyme.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they stanzas?
They are. Yep, they're all kinds of stanzas.
How fun. That is really fun.
There's even terza rima in the
tell everyone what that is.
That is a rhyme of three, it's tercets, three lines in a stanza, and the middle line is picked up in the first line of the next stanza.
That is a real workman. That's done. A real craftsman. Right. And you have had four chapbooks, including The Last Gun, which was judged as an award-winning poem. So you live in Washington, have seven books of poetry altogether. And what really I did not know about you is that you were an editor of a soccer anthology, because two of your sons were professional soccer players that retired. So just quickly, did you attend their games? Are you an expert on soccer?
I'm a soccer mom still, even at my age, but no, I'm not an expert on soccer, but I love soccer. I think I know pretty much what's going on when I watch a game. I better after all this time. But yeah, both my sons played professionally, one with the U.S. national men's team in the 1994 and the 98 World Cups. And he's now a soccer commentator on television. His name is Alexi Lalas. And my other son, Greg Lalas, is also a retired professional soccer player.
Well, that is something no other poet has ever told me. So we will switch gears and go back to your poetry. Anne Harding Woodworth, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are at the Library of Congress, although we are on remote. Here's Anne.
This is called, well, let me set this up with telling you that recently, or the last couple of years, I've really enjoyed Cosmopolitan magazine. Now, I am not your usual target for Cosmo, I can assure you. But my daughter-in-law is the executive editor of Cosmo, and I thought, I better start reading this magazine, know what she's up to. So and I was kind of, there wasn't any poetry in it. But I thought, maybe I can find lines in Cosmo that I can put together as a poem. And so I began going through, I did 2 years worth, 24 poems of what I call convolutes.
But with Centos, we always did that. We took lines from different poets. So that isn't...
It's a cento. It is very much like a cento.
Let's hear it.
I call them convolutes. And this is a convolute called Ars Poetica, remembering Alice Walker's poem, When the End Comes, which was the only time I've ever seen poetry mentioned in Cosmo. Every line here is from the June 19 Cosmopolitan. With glasses from your nightstand, you stare at a poem. It's lavender and lemongrass, scents that hold memories. Reading poetry, you explore the world, fairy tale world, misinformation, harsh reality, full range of expression, mysterious and unpredictable. Inside the secret world of poetry, there is a series of questions, impression, silence, a reflection in the mirror. A poet can cause the heart to ache, even when, or especially when, the end comes. So much love, so much warmth. How can a writer do this to you?
I think Cosmopolitan has poetry in it.
They do.
Those are beautiful lines.
They are, I know.
Are every line came from Cosmopolitan magazine?
Yes, every line.
Even the last one?
I go through the magazine and get about 250 lines that I like. And then I look through and see if I begin to see a theme, and then I put them together.
That is magic. Do you think you can get your daughter-in-law to insert poetry? I think once Cosmopolitan did have poetry.
I think they did a long time ago, yeah. Before Shirley Brown. Yeah.
Yes. But do you think that it would be, I guess the kind of poetry would not be, it would have to be for the general public, and then it would have to be a certain kind of poetry. So that causes a problem.
But I think they could do it. And it would have to be targeted.
Accessible, very accessible.
But also for the young. They are.
Oh, the young, I remember them. Yes. And keep going, please. And tell us. You're doing, like you do everything you just are so venturesome with form. You just go everywhere to find a poem.
I do.
So you certainly do. And here it is. Go ahead.
Well, this this poem, you know, if the other day I heard that the ugliest word in the English language is moist. M-O-I-S-T, moist. And I think it's a beautiful word. I did a search in my word for moist, how many times I had used it in my poems. I mean, I had so many poems where I had used the word moist. But what I'm going to read you is one called hoist. And I think that's a pretty word too, but has quite a different sound to it from moist. This poem came out, it's an ekphrastic poem. It's based on a photograph done by a photographer and friend of mine in Bristol, England, Alex Rotas, who goes around photographing people over 60 doing athletic feats, most of it track and field. And this poem is based on a photograph of Alex's where Reinhard Dahms, 73 years old, is pole vaulting. Hoist. I never thought I could lift against all the laws, gravity being the least of them. I never thought I could hold myself in flight, a body unattached to anything of earth except by a pliant pole. So when I plant it, I am released by miracle. My legs, my hips, my shoulders rise in concert, and I hoist. I hoist. I hoist myself beyond all thoughts of arrival.
There is the lesson. There's the lesson for us, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I hoist myself beyond all thoughts of arrival. We better live that way.
That's right.
And this is an awesome picture. I mean, I wish I had a visual of it, because yeah. He's this man with white hair in midair, his legs just askew. And now I want you to tell people what ekphrastic means.
Ekphrastic is a poem that would be in response to a piece of art. Alex's poem, Alex's photographs, for instance, are truly works of art. And so that's why I wrote an ekphrastic poem based on her photograph.
And you also have done it about other things, like your miniature poem. You have done, I think there was a painting of breasts.
And yeah, it's a miniature. It's only about 1 inch by 2 inches. It's a real selfie from the 18th century.
From the 18th century.
Yeah. She was a miniaturist that lived in those days.
You wrote a beautiful poem about that. So people, it doesn't even have to be a work of art, actually. How about a picture? People can write a poem about, you know, we look at William Carlos Williams' pictures from Bruegel. He literally just looked at pictures from Bruegel. So I recommend that. You're giving us a whole lesson on poetry, and I love it. So let's have more lessons by your poems.
All right.
We will learn much.
This is a memory poem. And it's about a time just post-war United States, 1946. And it was my parents' 10th anniversary, which my father forgot. 10th anniversary forgotten, 1946. 3 years after I was born, she was ready to give birth again. Time to forget the war. Time to laugh, time to get on with the job of making babies and money. My father sat at the table with us three girls, waiting for her to descend. What could she be doing upstairs? Why wasn't she dishing out dinner? Quiet, she's coming down now. And that's when the bride appeared in a maternity dress and a yellowed tulle veil gathered over her hair by combs, festooned with silk, fertile orange blossoms. The groom, who'd forgotten the day, had forgotten how to laugh, cried the most sudden tears I'd ever seen.
That is an anecdote which is true, right?
Yes.
But, you know, when I teach anecdotes, I say there has to be a philosophical platform under that, mm-hmm. or it's just a little chance remark. So what do you think is the philosophical meaning under that?
Well, I was really thinking of my father and about wartime America and how people were trying to get back onto their feet. And he had forgotten their anniversary. And there she was. And yeah. it just was so moving to him. And he felt so badly for, and yet, he loved her so much.
But I think the significance is that we were all at that period in history, people were really knocked off their feet. And I think that is a good poem that examines that. I wanted to talk a moment about public service, because all of the poets I know that are lasting have always been poets in the Republic of Poetry. And you have been serving on the poetry board, the Folger Poetry Board, mm-hmm. helping to present and proliferate and keep poetry alive. And then you're also a governor on the Emily Dickinson. Is it her society or?
It's the Emily Dickinson Museum in Amherst, Massachusetts.
Poetry does not happen by itself. I mean that. It could vaporize were it not if the poets furthering other poets. I mean, even think of Ezra Pound, what he did with all the poets, as nutty as he was. Look at what he did for all those poets, including T.S. Eliot. It takes putting your shoulder to the wheel, and Anne Harding Woodworth. I want to recognize that in you. And I also want to hear more poetry.
Thank you, Grace. Here in Washington, D.C., we have a wonderful poet named Truth Thomas, who has invented a form called the skinny. And when I heard about his skinny, I thought, I want to do that because I really do enjoy doing form. And so the skinny has I've done a poem of three skinnies together. A skinny has 11 lines. And there's some repetition, one word, each line is one word except for the first and the last. And one word is repeated two other times.
It sounds hard.
It isn't. It's just fun to do.
Well, give it to us.
This is a very serious poem in spite of it being a skinny. Birds keep no borders. Three skinnies for June 23rd, 2019, the Rio Grande. Father and daughter drowned, face down, river, separating, families, face down, languages, nations, love, face down, daughter and father drown. Birds keep no borders, freedom resides in birdsong, freedom from cages, limiting freedom. No borders keep birds. Daughter and father sing. Fly across border rivers. Fly your song home. Fly, sing, father and daughter.
Wow, isn't that interesting how the one monosyllabic line, one poem on a line is like a drumbeat as you read it. Mm-hmm. It is so powerful, the repercussion. And then you start the first stanza with a long line, then there's just single words, then you end the stanza with a long line.
A repetition. It's a repetition of the first, or perhaps slightly changed, but so the first and last line are the same words.
And you do that again for two more stanzas. Does it have to have three stanzas?
No.
Oh, okay. Anything you want.
Just one. It could be one skinny. Yeah.
Well, that is something. I've got a whole workshop here. You've given me a whole workshop. I want you to talk a little bit about Hannah. Who is Hannah in trouble?
Hannah.
Trouble is, first of all, the name of the book. Hannah's not in trouble.
Hannah Alive is the name of the poem, which became a play. And her name is Hannah Hyatt O'Reilly, which is H2O, and she's a great swimmer and loves water. And she's in her 80s, a widow. She has a dog named Max, and she has some sons who she fears are trying to put her into a nursing home, and she does not want to do that. So Hannah goes over all the different ways she might do herself in before that happens.
And that is a pretty powerful premise.
Yeah. It had a wonderful reading. It had a reading here in DC with one of our great actors, Kimberly Schraff.
My favorite.
Who played Hannah. Yeah. And she was just terrific. Yeah.
And we won't tell people how it ends. They'll have to buy Trouble.
Right?
The book Trouble. And if you want to know what happens to Hannah, if she survives or drowns, you must get Anne Harding Woodward's book. And so move along, Anne, with your journey in poetry.
This is a villanelle. Which is a poem of two rhymes. In this poem, the rhymes are a long I sound and a long E sound. And what I love about this poem is a dancer here in DC heard it and wanted to dance to it, which she did. Cherise Hogue is her name. She's a poet as well. And she's a fabulous dancer. And she took this poem and danced to it, which was absolutely beautiful. It's called Francesca's Song, and it's in the voice of a woman who is dying in a hospital. Francesca's Song. Come closer to my ears and eyes. Your mouth I want to see and hear. Speak out the sounds of willow sighs. It's never long to realize how good it feels to have you near. Come closer to my ears and eyes and fill my mouth with cubes of ice that help me swallow fever fears and listen for your willow sighs that emanate from deep inside your lungs and throat. Do come near, closer to my ears and eyes, so I can touch your breath. I'll rise or try to meet you partway there and fold me in your willow sighs. I think sometimes of winged rides, but I'm not getting out of here. Come closer to my ears and eyes. I'll run my fingers down the sides along your cheeks, their tear veneer that speaks the sound of willow sighs. Come closer now, my ears, my eyes.
And now a final poem by Anne Harding Woodward.
This is called Swans at Dusk, and it's from my poem, The Artemis Sonnets, etc. Swans at Dusk. Mating at this in-between hour is not the essence of their presence together on the water's glimmer. They swim like sun and moon skies that flow out of, into one another. It is the slow paddle of lovers who wait patiently for the moment of eclipse. Not for the violent myth that is expected of them. They anticipate the lake swells and bubbles that rise from beneath lightly to their breasts and bring on simultaneous beak smiles of swan tranquility, perhaps a slight lifting of a wing merely out of the joy of what water brings to them. The snort and hiss that will speak the throes of copulation are in reserve this perfect moment before when quiet prevails and acquiescence propels cob and pen alike on the darkening water into each other's curved neck.
The voice of Anne Harding Woodworth. The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.